Okay, I want to welcome you all. Thank you all for coming tonight. I really, really appreciate it. This is just so wonderful to see you all in this beautiful facility. This is, as you know, the Board of Supervisors Chambers. This is where they meet every Tuesday. I am Jill Bolster-White, and I'm the Director of Transitions Mental Health Association, and I just wanted to start by mentioning a couple of things about how this documentary came to be. First of all, when I first started in mental health, I was a volunteer from the agency that was known as Mental Health Association in 1989. And when I started, family members were not really part of the equation in mental health services. During my training and during my work, it was really not focused on looking holistically at families as they participated in the mental health system at all. And I have to say, sometimes it feels like we're banging our heads against various walls, but I think things have improved dramatically in mental health care because 7 years ago, San Luis Obispo County Mental Health decided to fund a family advocate. And Janice Holmes, who you all know, our spiritual leader, I think of her, was hired and really made a profound difference, I think, in how the system views our clients and our families, and certainly for those of us who've worked in mental health for a long, long time, how we viewed what we did and how we viewed the whole process of working with clients and as they all move to their recovery. So anyway, I just wanted to say I think that's been a tremendous thing. And again, I think so often it feels like it's a hard slog, and I think it is, but I also want to say that there are a lot of positive things that have happened. And that to me has been a very, very important, very positive change in the system. I also think when I think about this documentary, and we got to Dr. Karen Baylor, who is the mental health director for the county, and she and I got to view it yesterday, and I'm going to acknowledge some folks in just a moment who were really critical to the development of this documentary. But I love the story of how it came to be because I think it really represents San Luis Obispo County in so many ways. For some of you who may remember, the Tribune ran a story about the homeless outreach program, and it featured a man named Michael Rowe who had graduated from Cuesta College with his AA degree. And it was a great story. It talked about the mental health court. It talked about Mike Ball. It basically just talked about how the system really worked positively for this person. And so the producer of the documentary, Jose, called Karen Baylor, the mental health director, and basically got sort of in contact. It was sort of the 6 degrees of separation. Karen put him in contact with Mike Ball, who put him in contact with Michael Rowe. And then Michael Ball said, you know, I think you should talk to Janice Holmes. She's the family advocate. I think that she would be another good person for you to talk to as you're looking at this whole system. And that was the moment from which this documentary actually that was sort of hatched, was talking to Janice and talking to families and really seeing how important, again, this whole continuum, if you look at this whole mental health system holistically, he decided that a documentary about the families was a really important project. So anyway, let me introduce you to some of the people who are critical to this whole project. And I wanted to make sure that you got to meet Jose behind the camera once again, and his wife Mary, the producer and director of this. Thank you very, very much. Again, without them, this wouldn't have happened. And as Janice Holmes said, they really were some of the first people who are not family members who really saw how important walking in the shoes of family members was. And I thought that that was a very important an important distinction. Another really important partner who I appreciate a lot is Dr. Karen Baylor. She's the administrator of the mental health department here for the county, and she is also a really important, as an organization, we feel like that's a very important partnership, and so she's the one who greenlit this project and the funding through Mental Health Services Act funds. So I wanted to acknowledge her. She deserves a hand. I also wanted the mental health board folks to raise their hands or wave. We have mental health, quite a bit of the mental health board here. Thank you all very much for coming. And they serve an important role to advise the department and advise the Board of Supervisors. And I also wanted to mention Jim Patterson. Supervisor Jim Patterson is here representing the Board of Supervisors of this district. I really appreciate that. We also have several members of the Transitions Mental Health Association board, and they're all over here. If they could wave their hands, I really appreciate them. Also, really important people and very vocal advocates. The Mental Health Board and Transitions Mental Health Association board, very vocal mental health advocates, which is really an important role to play. I also would like hands up from county mental health staff and Transitions Mental Health Association staff, who all also are part of the mental health system and really are they're the people who brought in all the plants, and they're the people who printed the schedules and all that sort of thing, and also do the day-to-day work with your loved ones. And so they're also very, very important parts of the system. I think they deserve to be recognized. And like many of these sort of low-budget events, we have really important sponsors. I mentioned that the Mental Health Services Act sponsored the bulk of this documentary, and that was through the Mental Health Department. And also on your program, it talks about the other sponsors who we have. Jose and Mary are sponsors. Gala, San Luis Print and Copy, Sherry Seehoff. We have quite a few folks. I know that Outspoken Coffee is a sponsor. And I really, really appreciate the sponsorship, and that's also what made this happen, as well as the County Board of Supervisors and making this chamber available. I wanted to say a few just housekeeping things, and that is, if everyone could make sure their cell phone is off, that will keep me from being very annoyed if it goes off in the middle of the film. And also, the building is not open beyond just the area where we're showing the film and where our reception is. So please don't go into any of the hallways or upstairs or any of that. That's part of the responsibility we have in using this building. And what we're going to do is show the film. And then Dr. Baylor is going to come up. She's going to introduce our speaker, Dr. Jamie Rotanofsky. And then we're going to have an opportunity for questions and answers. There's a white piece of paper that you got. And so if you've got a question now, or if one occurs to you during the film or afterwards, we're going to take the questions in writing. And then Dr. Baylor and I will play Oprah, and we'll make sure that everybody's, you know, as many questions as we can manage to ask and get answered as possible, and that will happen after Dr. Rotanofsky speaks. I mentioned that the plants are from Growing Grounds Farm. I think they really spruce up the place. We should really be talking to the Board of Supervisors about a permanent installation, I think. So I think, without further ado, I would like to present the Shaken Tree.
That starts to display symptoms of mental illness. You may not even know what it is. You just know that something's wrong.
With my first wife, Pauline, I didn't realize she had a mental illness. You know, I knew her mother, you know, had problems because, like, one time her mother had a fence built on the roof, a barbed wire fence built on the roof, and that kind of, you know, tipped me off.
When we go to diagnose mental illness, what we're looking at is, like, supposedly discrete categories. Somebody has major depression, or they have bipolar disorder, or they have schizophrenia. But rarely do people fit a simple symptom picture like that. And you've got a lot of people who have a lot of different problems, so it's not such a clear-cut issue.
When we discovered our daughter was diagnosed with bipolar disorder, for one, I had no idea. I don't know where I was in the universe, but I never heard bipolar.
He had voices going on, and I found out recently he actually was seeing people just standing that weren't there.
We had no indication that our son was ever thinking about suicide or that that was even an option. He'd never given us any indication, never said anything, never made threats. He was not a troubled kid. We saw that he dealt with depression. We could see the severe highs and severe lows, but it didn't seem anything out of the ordinary, very much like any teenager.
She was a cutter. She cut herself.
When someone first finds out that their loved one is diagnosed with mental illness, it's an incredible deep down pain inside.
When it first started to become apparent how serious it was, I searched my mind like how I would describe it, and the term tragic nightmare came to my mind.
One of the biggest things is fear, because when your loved one is out there and you don't know where they are, and in our case, just living out in the trees.
The darkest moment that I've had with bipolar disorder with our daughter Sarah was when I wasn't sure whether she was going to come home, whether we would have a phone call from some law enforcement someplace that, you know, your daughter's either committed suicide, which she has tried, or or killed, or just overdosed, because she probably went through almost all the different drugs to self-medicate.
Many, many people who have mental illness sometimes will start treating themselves, especially as young adults, with street drugs and alcohol.
If you have what they call a dual diagnosis, then it's just, you're just kind of out there searching for something.
Emotionally, a roller coaster that doesn't stop. It rolls over you, and all of a sudden you're on that ride again. And so stress-wise, it's just the hugest thing. You tear down, you can get very low yourself, you get angry, it's a grief.
When I was 11, I was at a friend's house in our apartment complex, and I just had a sense in my stomach that I needed to go home and check on my mom. I was in the middle of playing, and I was like, you know, I gotta go. And I went home, and I walked in to find my mom had tried to take her own life for the second time.
Anger at what's happened, despair early on, thinking that it will never get better, regret, even though there was nothing that I could have done to prevent this from happening.
He went into the bathroom and came out, and he told me that he loved me, and we talked, and good night, and I was sleeping just 2 feet away from him. In the morning, I wake up first, and I wake him up. He wakes up, and he's groggy. He says, I'm still here. Then told us I tried to kill myself, and that's why he told me that he loved me. He's better now.
Will is my life partner, and we've been together for 21 years, and he suffers from depression. He was assaulted or mugged between the severe beating he experienced and the physical problems. He now suffers from depression and post-traumatic stress disorder.
Everybody's life has changed in a way that they did not wish, that they didn't ask for, that they may feel guilty unnecessarily or ashamed about, and they really need to process it.
And she had seen a doctor when it was under a physician's care. She actually went into him on a Thursday and asked him for an antidepressant. And she was brave enough to say, I am depressed. I need help. He didn't remind her that this particular drug would take, I don't know what this one was, I can't recall, you know, 6, 7 to 10 to 14, some take up to a month to really kick in fully. And it was the following Tuesday when she took her life. So Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, 5 days.
Most elderly people who commit suicide go to their medical doctor within the last week of their life, complaining about the physical symptoms of depression, do not get diagnosed appropriately, and do not get treated appropriately.
My mother shot herself. That's part of my life. It changed my life profoundly. And for me to have to be hushed about that and not talk about that or pretend to myself, oh, but I'll never do that. We could all do that. We can all go there. Just like we can all get cancer.
Mental illness doesn't discriminate. It can hit anyone, anytime, any age, any family, any ethnic background.
And I had incredible fear because this was my mother and that was my genes. She had taught me everything I knew, and she also gave me her genes. Did I have that? Was that going to be me?
That's when she called me at work and told me that I should probably come home. And she said, you're going to find a bloody mess here. She said, I've been cutting myself. I had no idea what to do. I've never seen that any kind of mental illness. It was just so bizarre and new to me that I said, you sit tight. I can make it home in 15 minutes. And so I did. And I walked in and I looked in the bathroom, and of course it was just blood all over the place. And then I went to open her bedroom, and I couldn't get in. She had piled furniture against the door. And I called her name, and she said, yes. You know, she answered me. And I said, can I come in? She said, I don't think you should. And I said, okay. And don't ask me where I got the strength, because I'm not that big of a person, but I just put my shoulder to the door and just shoved it open, I guess, with adrenaline and everything. And I just took her in my arms and I said, we're going to be okay.
My heart's been broken beyond words. I've lost both my parents. I've lost a brother to cancer. There's been a lot of grief involved in that, but nothing compares to the grief that I feel with my son and still do.
I grieve even to this day over the change that has occurred in our lives. The fact that the life that we were planning and that we had been living will never be quite the same.
You know, sometimes people will ask, well, how's George? And I will say things like, well, George's life is a very difficult struggle. And I have used that term, it's been a heartbreaking nightmare. Yeah. Or, and I have said, you know, George, he has a preliminary diagnosis of bipolar 1, and it's a mental illness.
We're so darn open about it. We told everybody.
Nobody wants to say, oh, great, well, we'll have you over for dinner now. You know, they don't do that.
This is the non-casserole illness. If you said, oh, my son was diagnosed with cancer, people would be there with their casseroles.
You know, I've been struggling with mental illness since he was in his late 20s. He's schizophrenic, and he at times has been quite paranoid, suspicious of medication, doctors, treatments. Was in and out of jails and hospitals. He actually begged the policeman to shoot him in the head. And he was filthy, he'd been homeless, he just was desperate. And I think he, at that point, he really wanted to die.
It does impact the whole family. And I feel sometimes like the older kids maybe tend to come home less. It's hard, you know, they have little kids. And it's been so hard on us, I think it's hard for them to be around us sometimes. So.
She was in treatment centers pretty much from the time I was 9 till I was out of the house. We shared a room and shared a bed, and so if I didn't get up before her without waking her, then she would beat me pretty badly in the mornings before school. My mom worked evenings and nights, and so we were kind of, we'd have someone there with us overnight, but there was like a crossover time. Times were really different back then. And I would actually have to get up, but I would go to school. I'd be at school by 6:30 in the morning just to avoid my sister's wrath. And thankfully there was a really amazing janitor who let me in and would just listen to me, and he'd be waiting for me to show up every morning. And through the years, she's become addicted to drugs, marijuana, and then methamphetamines. And we've had long periods of time of estrangement. Just she's homeless and lives on the streets, and so there's times where I just simply don't know how to find her or where she's at. I'm really good at finding people now. I know how to track her down, but it's difficult as far as knowing how to love and encourage her, but also having to say, no, you can't stay at my house, and no, I'm not going to drive you to that individual's home because I don't feel safe. And it's hard to see my sister with no shoes sometimes because she's lost the 8 pair I've given her, or to know that she's maybe hungry.
Parents do probably need to set boundaries with their kids, you know, and families with their family members, whether they have a mental illness or not. And in particular, yeah, I think allowing somebody with a mental illness to live in your home and violate perhaps all your limits and the rules of your household isn't reasonable. There's probably nothing anybody feels worse about than putting their child out on the street. But sometimes that's the only way that individual is going to learn to modify their behavior or change what they're doing or learn how other people in the world respond to them or what kinds of behaviors they do bring out in other people.
2 months before his 21st birthday, he had been dealing with severe depression and just didn't come home. We knew something was seriously wrong. He went up to Highway 41 and decided to suicide up there.
Losing about 30,000 people to suicide every year. And that's, you know, it's really a significant number, and I think we think of our country, we think about violence rates, but actually the suicide rate is much higher than our rate for homicide. homicides. And worldwide, the rate of suicide is higher than all homicides and wars combined.
Atascadero police or sheriff, I'm not even sure, found him and notified us. And so we started that long, horrible process that all families go through of why and what exactly would bring him to that much desperation. We'll never know why. We'll never know what kind of pain that he must have been in, that he felt a permanent solution was necessary.
What's been the hardest for us is that he has been suicidal at times and threatened suicide a lot.
Thousands of times.
thousands of times.
Oh, sure. I'd rather be dead. There's no point in living.
I think it's really difficult for a family when one of its members has chronic mental illness issues, and particularly suicidality, that's ongoing, that's kind of a suicidal career, if you will, where they are suicidal on and off throughout their life. And I think part of the strain on the family is there are a lack of resources.
And within 5 days, our insurance said he is no longer a threat. They would only hospitalize him when he was a threat to himself or others, as they said. So.
And if he would have said, yeah, I still want to kill myself, they would have kept him. But they got him to a point, are you going to kill yourself? No. Not, I think about it a lot, but I'm not going to do it today. Okay, then you can go.
We don't have long lengths of stay inpatient anymore in this country. I mean, the average length of stay is 3 or 4 days. Now, if you think about somebody who's experiencing a major depressive episode, and the majority of medications for depression take 2 or 3 weeks to be fully effective, how do you stabilize somebody on antidepressants in 3 days? You don't. How do you make sure they're going to take their medication therapeutically when they go home? What we'd really like to see is a more continuum of care model, where we go from when people are in the hospital when they need to be, to having maybe day treatment in the community as a support, to then having, you know, more regular therapy, whatever the person needs.
We went, for whatever reason, to find the site that he chose to suicide. We had a map from the coroner's office, and we were driving through the back roads off of 41, and just couldn't seem to find our way. We finally ended up on a gravel road that said no trespassing, and we had to keep going to find an actual place to turn around, and it seemed like we went for miles when we pulled over because we saw a man on a tractor. And I asked him where the specific road was, and the look on his face, and he stopped, he looked at me, and he said, may I ask why? And I said, our son died up there. And he said, ma'am, not only do I know where the road is, but I am the person that found your son. That was several miles from where he actually died, and a complete fluke that we would have run across this man. I believe it was as healing for him as it was for us to be able to put a face and a family with the young man that he stumbled across.
Depression is horrible, and he had that for years and years, and it's so, and as horrible as it is, mania is much worse for the family.
He was scaring people, you know.
Oh, yeah.
He was intimidating people, getting into confrontations with one of his professors, and he told his roommate, if I die, don't worry, because I'm coming back.
Part of the mania, he thought he was God.
And he still refers to his psychotic break as an epiphany.
We went through a lot of bad times. It wasn't, I mean, it's not that all of a sudden, you know, she had bipolar and now she's great. I mean, there were years and years and years where it was horrible.
The most difficult thing for me has been watching him for about a 6-month, 9-month period after this happened, while we were trying to seek help, trying to find the best help possible, was watching him deteriorate as a person, watching him feel worthless, feel angry, he had great feelings of distrust of everyone around him, including me, on occasion. And just watching that struggle that he went through, was devastating to me as well.
I thought, I don't know if she has any insurance. You know, it was all so new to me. And I knew she wasn't covered by us because she was already 22 years old. And I said, I think I'm going to call the county mental health. That just came in my head. I said, well, go talk to them and see what the next step should be. And she said, I'm so glad you're here. And it was pretty heart-rending. And so she and I just drove right over there, and the woman that met us talked her into staying. And she did not object at all.
Through the homeless outreach program, mental health court, and a little bit of manipulation on my part, that he has finally gotten the help he needs.
She wanted help. And I think, in a way, it was fear, because she's seen her mother. And it was fear of becoming like that. And she just knew she needed help, and she was going to get it.
And she comes and she speaks to our family-to-family classes, and people just hang on her every word. And they look at her, and they see how she is now, and it gives them hope.
There are a lot of families out there that live with mental illness and have very good lives. Their loved ones go on to get their degrees, to get married, to have families. It doesn't have to be a life sentence. It just feels like it initially.
Get educated, and that's empowerment. Learn as much as you can in any instance.
Families do educate themselves and do know about medications and diagnoses and what to expect and what not to expect. You have to. You have to, because you have to know what you're facing.
We were very, very lucky. I had Sarah down at mental health one day, and I'm standing there and I'm looking around. I happen to see a flyer in the window, and it talked about this NAMI presented family to family 12-week education course. One night a week, everything is provided for you. I called. They happened to have a space. And so Danny and I got in on it, and every week it was just like, I don't want this to ever end, because it was like somebody threw you a life preserver. It gives you the most current information. It talks about the new medications. It talks about how you're affected as a family. It describes the illnesses. And then Danny and I turned around, and we became teachers.
Yeah. Plus, this family-to-family course has to be taught by someone outside of the medical field that is a family member of someone, just like us.
One time I went to the doctor, and this was with George, and I said, and he was going to get a mood elevator, and he left the room, and so I said to the doctor, I feel really bad too, can you give me something? And she looked at me and said, you're supposed to feel bad. And she wouldn't give me anything, which is okay. And then when he had his psychotic break and was just devastating, and I went back to her and I said, can you give me something? And she said, yes, without a doubt. She did. And it turned out that I didn't want to take, I took it like 3 weeks, and I just thought, you know, I can just feel miserable. It's okay.
And it's not unusual for family members to tell you that they might have had to take antidepressants or go to therapy themselves or go to grief counseling, you know, during the process of dealing with the early stages of a psychiatric illness of a family member.
One of my mantras was, you can't stop the waves, but you can learn to surf. And I actually took that literally right after, a year after this crisis came into our family. I decided to learn how to boogie board. And with another friend, we started a boogie board club with women.
We have some good friends who absolutely have stayed bias and have been supportive, and these are wonderful people. To be outside, those things are helpful, and Jim has been helpful for me. We're going to go on a cruise next week. We have some fun things to do.
I turn to prayer and journaling, and journaling meaning I write out hard stuff sometimes.
People will say, keep a hobby, take care of yourself, do something that you really like to do. And sometimes when you're in crisis,
it's kind of hard to go out and garden or find joy in the kind of things that you used to really like to do, whether it was a craft or whatever. Sometimes you just don't have the energy to immerse yourself in something like that. And one of the things that I found was just find little reminders and put them up all over the place of things that make you smile, things that uplift you somehow, whether it's a little comment. For instance, I took a picture of my granddaughter. She's got this quirky little look on her face, and every time I look at it, it makes me laugh. And it just takes me to a better place.
We found Transitions, which is Janice Holmes's group there in San Luis Obispo, and we talked to Janice. That was really the first time, I think, that we really felt like there was somebody out there who had some resources that would help us.
The family advocacy program that has been in San Luis County for 7 years just continued to grow exponentially. It's amazing to me how many families need services. There's approximately 50 new families every month.
This is an extended family.
It is.
And that you can come here and say out loud, my brother's schizophrenic, and be totally accepted. No one's going to look at you like you're not normal or your family's not normal.
Provide them with services, have appointments, one-on-one private appointments, or bring them to the family support group that we have every Tuesday. And that group is huge. We have at least 20 to 30 people every Tuesday.
I'm even asked now, where did you get the help for your son? I said, by chance, by luck, we talked to these people from Transition. They said, yes, we'll help you. I said, then the therapy for us has been going to the meetings and knowing that it's not just us.
The most amazing thing is how much a support group like this means to us, because usually it's all about the ones that are mentally ill, and we're just kind of in the backwaters.
I wish that every family that has a loved one in an immediate mental illness, brain disease crisis could get into a family support group the next day, because it makes it so much easier. Don't be afraid. Believe me, no one's going to judge you, no matter how awful things seem.
You know, it's just like even with cancer or anything, they have support groups. You know, why can't we? It's no difference, except that I have hope now, and I didn't have hope before I came here.
This group also, I think, you know, gives you ammo to talk to the professional. You get the words, you get the lingo, you know what everybody's been through, you know what SSI means, you know what 5150 means.
It helps. You know, just, you walk out of there
laughing. I love that.
Mental illness is hereditary. It's very true, because you get it from your kids.
You know, that person's not identified by their mental illness. This is my mom. This is my sister. I love them. They're funny. We have great times together. It's not something on the forefront of my conversation. It doesn't have to be this odd thing like, this is my mom. She has bipolar disorder. I said, this is my mom, and I love her. She's got a great smile. She's a fun person to be around. This is my sister, and she's got a compassionate heart. So I guess I don't really worry about it anymore. And if it comes up, it comes up, and I try and take opportunities to educate people. But it's not the first thing I feel like I have to run out and say, but it's not a secret. I'm not ashamed of them, any part of them.
We hope that our loved ones get the help they need. We hope that our loved ones choose to get help, take their medication, accept their diagnosis, and get on with their lives. That's your ultimate hope. But what I like to help families come to terms with is, even if they don't do that, there's hope for you, that you can get on with your life, that you can understand that that's their choice. And you may not like it, but you get to accept it and move on and get to have your life back.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm Karen Baylor, the Behavioral Health Administrator, and I just want to thank all of you for coming. And it just this film just really touched my heart, and I really want to thank all the family members who participated. I know it's hard to talk about this, but it's so important to share your story with others. And when Mike Ball and I first started talking about doing this, it just seemed to fit in so well with what we're trying to accomplish through the Mental Health Services Act. And so I really want to thank everybody and for sharing your story, and thank you very much as well, Janice Holmes. That was just... So, it is my... I know you'll pay me later. It's my profound... Yes. Oh, you want me to talk about the cards? We'll come and collect the cards, walk up and down the aisles, and we'll be collecting the cards if you have any questions you'd like to ask. But I'd like to introduce Dr. Jamie Rothnowski. She is the executive director of the Glendon Association since October 06, so she's just doing her first year, completing her first year. She's also a consultant, clinical trainer, professional coach since January of 1990. And previously has worked for the County of Santa Barbara as a manager of crisis services. She has a PhD in clinical psychology, a master's of education in psychological counseling, a master's of arts in organizational psychology. She is a certified rehabilitation counselor, a certified national psychodramatist, and a qualified medical examiner, and of course, a licensed psychologist here and in New York. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Rothnowski.
Well, thank you for having me here. I just want to apologize that Dr. Lisa Firestone couldn't be here. She had to be with a family member. It was really important, so I sent her apologies. But I'm really glad to be here and see this premiere of this amazing movie that is quite moving. And I'm sure a lot of people sat here and had a lot of different feelings and emotions about that. But as was already stated, how important it is to talk about it and not let this be silent, and the courage it takes to share the stories. And a lot of what we're talking about is empowerment, and the way that we do that is by sharing the stories, getting the word out, and advocating. So I really appreciate you all being here. There's information also about Glendon and how to save a life. I'm going to go over some of the risk factors. But one of the concerns when we look at data as far as statistical information is that when we look at St. Louis Obispo in particular and compare it to Santa Barbara, it has a higher suicide rate. When we look at St. Louis Obispo and we compare it to California, it has a higher suicide rate. And we take St. Louis Obispo and compare it to the national average, it is higher. So it's a really important issue to address here. Sometimes we don't know why that is, but that is real. And that's data that we did want to bring and give that information to you. But you have a lot of opportunities to address this. Again, through advocacy, through the Mental Health Service Act, that's the Prop 63, and have a voice in what's designed here for St. Louis Obispo. So take advantage of that. Be involved and get more information about that. Okay. So I want to talk to you a little bit about the risk factors, because the way we help people is by knowing what to do, just like we do with people that may have heart attacks, that people learn CPR and first aid. Learning how to help someone in crisis and what to do is just as important. Okay. So some of the signs and symptoms many of you, I know the video talked about as well, but when someone is isolating, they retreat, they no longer participate in activities they used to participate in. Okay, they're not maybe getting up anymore. They stay in bed. They start giving away items. They might even talking about not wanting to live anymore. So we always want to take those kind of signs very seriously. And, of course, you'll see people that some people get depressed as well. But one thing we always like to address is that, especially when someone is suicidal, sometimes right before when they come up with a plan, they no longer appear depressed. So we don't want to be fooled or by that, thinking, oh, they're better now, they're happier. Because it's quite often, unfortunately, that happens, that people actually, right before they have a plan, they start feeling better and elated knowing that they have a plan. So please be careful of those kind of signs, as far as family members, you know, what you might see. So those are some of the signs and symptoms. Now, everyone's a little different. Now, some people don't get depressed. Some people get agitated. So there's such a thing called agitated depression. So again, when someone's acting differently, we're concerned about it. Another factor, of course, is mental illness. People that complete suicide, 90% of those people had some form of mental illness, some type of diagnosis. Depression, bipolar disorder, things of that nature. Postpartum depression is another area as well. 50%, and this is, believe me, a slanted figure, but 50% is what has been documented in various states of the people that complete suicide have drug or alcohol in their system. The reason that's not accurate is that not all states actually look for that. Okay, so we know it's much higher than that. But we also know drugs and alcohol is a factor. So specifically, when we talk about high-risk populations, one of the highest-risk populations is your homeless. People that are homeless. They've lost so much in their lives. They used to be lawyers, doctors, had lives as well. Now they're homeless. A lot of grief, a lot of loss, mental illness, alcohol and drugs as well. They're one of the highest risk factors because they have like four of them, of the red flags that we're concerned about. So, you know, taking care of our homeless is really important as well. Taking care of our family, our community, but also our homeless who really can't care for themselves. That's important as well. So those are some of the risk factors to identify. Now, what could we do? What are some of the helper tasks? Knowing what to do, okay? One thing is obviously to talk about it with the person. If you're concerned about someone, let them know. At one of the forums we just had recently, someone told a story that after the forum, they heard someone talking on a phone outside. They called their friend and they said, oh, I just attended this forum. It's really, really good. I learned so much. And one of the things they told me is that if you're worried about someone, talk to them about that and let them know. That's why I'm calling you. That can make all the difference in the world. Because people that are suicidal are ambivalent and conflicted. Part of them really does want to stay alive. Part of them wants to die. They're struggling with that. What's important about knowing that 90% of the people that complete suicide have mental illness, mental illness is treatable. Suicide is preventable. That's very powerful. So talk to people, engage them. You know, be warm and compassionate and just talk with them about what they're feeling, what they're doing, what's going on for them. Why do they feel this way? Some of the things not to do is, of course, say, oh, don't worry about it, it's going to get better. You know, sometimes we don't know what to do. Now, if you really feel frozen about it and don't know what to do, get someone else to help. Either bring them somewhere or call a hotline number, you know, and have someone else help. You don't have to do it all on your own. But it is important, especially for people that are mentally ill or have, you know, alcohol and drug issues as well, is that they need help to get to the right places. And I know how hard it is for families that keep struggling with this. And we just do the best we can with that struggle to try to get that help. And as the film talks about, also surviving yourself. Because, you know, when someone suffers from mental illness in the whole family system suffers with that person because we care about them. The other area that's really important to address, of course, is the stigma. And so people don't want to talk about it because of the stigma. And so your being here and advocating to get past that is really important. People are ashamed by this. You know, and even the term, and actually John Kevin Hines recently spoke, he's the gentleman that survived the Golden Gate Bridge jump, and now he's an advocate. And it's amazing. It's such a rare miracle that someone actually survives that. And he's very happy he's now married. And he talks about maybe, you know, in the future having children. You know, it's a man that, you know, really was serious, made a very serious attempt. And he talks about, he used to say, I'm mentally ill. He doesn't say that anymore. What he said recently was, he said, do you say, I am cancer? I am hypertension? I am diabetes? No. So the language is really important. How we speak about this is really important. You know? And again, the film really did a great job. This is my mother. This is my sister. These are people. Don't dehumanize it. And that's unfortunately what's been done. Not necessarily purposely, but again, how we talk about it's really important. And being aware of that and educating people about that. Okay? So again, try to engage the person, have them talk to you about it. Talk to them about if they have if they're going to do this, how might they do that? Because obviously, we're concerned about means, meaning they have a gun or they have medication or they have a plan. Obviously, that's more serious. We want to get them more immediate help. Okay. And another thing we advocate for is restriction of means, right? So gun control, building railings on bridges, restriction of means. And why it's so important is because we know the research shows that when we restrict means, there's a decrease in the suicide rate. So restriction of means. There are things we can do just environmentally and through public policy and laws that actually can help save lives as well. So there's so much opportunity, you know, to continue to work on this. And again, with the Prop 63, the Mental Health Service Act, it's a really amazing thing that there's actually money available because there are not enough resources. The film talks about it. Professionals talk about it. There's no continuum of service. And anyone that's a family member knows this. How many phone calls it took to maybe get help, you know, and not knowing where to turn and not being not quite serious enough, right, because of the laws, the whole 5150 and all that. So these are the things that we have to work to change. And it really is, you know, about being here tonight. It's about community empowerment. And you all have an opportunity to do that through advocacy, talking with other people, you know, talk to other people, educate them, help us get this film out there, help, you know, as many people that you could touch about this information, the more we could really change what's happening. I thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Dr. Rotnofsky. And it is a sobering thought to think that our county of San Luis Obispo has a higher rate than state and national average. And so I think that is a really important call to action. I know that they are collecting questions now. So if any of you have questions, please pass them to the baskets. They look a little bit like offering baskets. So if you want to throw a check in there, some cash, go ahead. I also wanted to reiterate one of the things that Dr. Baylor talked about, and that is the Mental Health Services Act, and Dr. Rotnofsky also mentioned. The Mental Health Services Act, it's one of its core designs was to be transformational, and I think that is a very important. We've already seen a lot of impact with that in terms of serving underserved and unserved folks here in this county, and I think it's really important that your voices be heard as far as that planning process. You've gotten to see people raise their hands who are on the Mental Health Board and who are on the Transitions Mental Health Association Board. I think that those are very, very important items. And I also think, again, about Supervisor Patterson and these chambers. And I think about 80% of the conversation here in these chambers is about land use issues. I've heard that. It seems like that when I listen to the meetings. And I think it's really important that we also make sure that the supervisors realize what an important and critical piece part that they play in the provision of mental health services and how important their activism is. I think the irony is not lost to me that Jose learned about the families through an article about the homeless outreach program, which has now been defunded by Governor Schwarzenegger. So I think, again, that's a really, I think it harkens back to the notion that it's important to talk about mental illness, to talk about the importance of treatment and care, to talk about how treatable it was. I think that's a great point, that it is extremely treatable, and these are treatable illnesses. People can recover. And I think those are really, really critical messages for us to continue to put out there on a wider scale. I think it'll educate the people who make decisions and who allocate funds, but I think it also makes a more accepting community if they can understand this, if they can see a movie like this and really understand that this is what we're talking about. We're talking about families and we're talking about children and parents, and I think that that's also very, very important because we're working against a lot of other messages that are very stigmatizing. So all those things I think are really important to keep in mind. Okay, we have some questions. Okay, that's great. Okay, the first question is, how could the county cut the homeless outreach program back when it is such a crucial part of the whole picture?
Wow, so that we planned that, we did not.
How can the county cut it? Well, the county had no choice. Our governor cut it. He eliminated that funding completely and eliminated $55 million to that program that was in 38 counties and left us with no alternative. So it's not something that we wanted to do. It's not something that we were in favor of. We supported lots of advocacy to change it, to try and convince the governor that was a wrong decision. We fought and fought and fought to try and prevent that from happening, and he blue-penciled it anyway. I know or I've heard that there's a lawsuit that is filed or potentially going to be filed regarding that, and so I don't know where that is, and usually those lawsuits take years to get resolved. So what we've done in the meantime was it was really important for us, for the folks that were being housed in that program, to remain in their housing. And so what we've done is worked real closely with Jill and her team and put together a plan so that we could move some of those folks under the Mental Health Services Act and be served that way. The real beauty of the HOP program was that they would go out into the streets and into the creek beds and find these people. That is gone. We had 5 different outreach and engagement workers out in our county from one end of the county to the other. That is gone. And it just breaks our heart that the governor made that decision. So when you feel the urge to advocate and want to send the governor a letter, please remember to include that in there, and we'll try and keep everyone posted on what happens with the lawsuit.
Yeah. In fact, I think San Luis Obispo County has done more than other counties to try to preserve the housing and the services for homeless outreach folks. So there's a question. I'm going to see if one of the family members will be willing to answer this one. Do you think the element of family secrecy has lifted significantly in the past 20 years or so? This was the hardest part about being a family member for me, is to not tell anyone to protect their loved one. I wanted to know if any of the family members might be willing to answer that. Maybe Janice? Anybody? Marie. Actually, Marie comes. Thank you.
I don't know, about 20 years ago actually is kind of when everything started for me, but it was a big secret in my family. And I think I was just asked this again recently of what's the difference. Why do you think it is that people in particular, even in their 20s, is the question that was posed to me, are afraid to talk about it, or there's such a stigma attached to it? I still think there's a huge stigma, and in particular in my age group, and I think a lot of that, speaking for myself, is because this is the age when you're trying to establish yourself, establish your career, establish who you are, and so there's stigma attached, and you don't want that label sometimes. But in the regards of protecting the family member, that's a huge piece of it. Like I said in the video, it's my mom, it's my sister. I don't want you to see them and go, oh, that person's going to be scary, or they're going to react, or have some misinformed expectation of how they might respond to you. So I think that's still a huge concern. I think it's still an ongoing thing that we need, as family members, need to continue to work to reduce that stigma, continue to be outspoken in a healthy, educated kind of way.
Okay, Esther's going to add something to that. That was Marie Hughes, and you saw her in the documentary. She also works for Transitions as a Parent Partner.
Well, I am a family member, and I have to say that it was an amazing experience for me to move from New York State to San Luis Obispo County and find out that this county had a family advocate. That was something I never experienced before. But one of the most remarkable things is to have classes and support groups for family members, because when you sit down at a table and everyone at that table shares the fact that someone they love dearly is mentally ill, you begin to get the courage to speak and to not deny what's true. And I think the support services and the classes that NAMI teaches, the family-to-family classes, those are remarkable. And I think that I am more of an advocate, even though I'm not out in the world all the time telling people this is what it is. I'm doing that a lot that I didn't do before, and I really think that we're on the way to it being better than it was.
Thank you, Esther. I agree. Okay. I have a question about, is it difficult to get into transitional housing if qualifications are met, and is it impacted? And Transitions contracts with the County Behavioral Health Services to provide transitional housing. And right now, transitional housing is full. So it tends to be impacted. It does tend to be a little bit full, but not always. And so what I would say is that it's probably like most other things, it's really about the timing, and the timing being right Right. So if you have a loved one who does meet target population, then you can work with the case manager at Behavioral Health Services and see if there might be an opening. I think that would be my answer. Okay. This is a question for Mike Ball. Are there 5150 or 5250 arrest information? Oh, is 5150 or 5250 arrest information shared between counties in the state of California?
Well, are 5150s and 5250s arrested between counties? It's a good question, and I have to tell you, I don't think so. I'm going to tell you I don't know the answer for sure, but because the confidentiality laws are so strict and that people who are fall under the statute of 5150 and are hospitalized, that information is very strict. It's hard to release that information. So my sense of this question is that this information is not shared between counties, and my sense is that if any of this information is shared between counties, that would have to come through release of information. So otherwise, if I'm on a 5150 in this county and I go to another county, that it's pretty difficult for that county to get information. I have to sign a release of information for another county to get that particular information. So I hope that answers the question. But basically, I do not think that this information is shared between counties.
But can you share what is happening in this county? Can you share, Mike, what is happening in this county with a forensics coordination team?
Yes. A couple months ago, or last month, we had our first forensic coordination team meeting. And in a nutshell, what this group is able to do, it's a group comprised of law enforcement and service providers. And there's a section in the Welfare Institutions Code that allows for a multidisciplinary team to gather. The criteria of this multidisciplinary team is that people can meet under a roof that have training in specific areas, and that we're able to meet and discuss people who live in the community who have a mental illness without the burden of confidentiality. So otherwise, law enforcement can call me, and normally we cannot exchange information. Under this particular welfare institutions code, it allows us to meet once a month and to, for the purposes of treatment, share information that normally would be confidential. The information that we're sharing has nothing to do with a specific accurate diagnosis and specific family history. It has to do with current behaviors and situations that we might be able to have an impact on. This is a result of the Mental Health Criminal Justice Task Force a few years ago. It's one of three goals we had of a mental health court, crisis intervention training, and now what we call forensic coordination team. So as time goes on, I'm hoping that we'll see some benefit.
I think it's important to talk about, the family advocate is involved with this group, but I think it is, as Mike describes this forensic coordinating team, which he chairs, I think it's important also to acknowledge how far things have come in law enforcement, too. That really, I talked earlier about the fact that family members weren't always part of the treating system, and law enforcement has really been brought in, and I think has been very open to and appreciative of working together. As you know, a lot of our family members do start in the law enforcement system. So I think that's made a tremendous difference. Here is a question for Dr. Baylor. Do you think that in order to have a relationship with God, it is okay to use medication even though you have a problem with all types of medication? For some reason, you feel that using medication creates a noticeable gap between you and God.
Well, the several of us that were over here huddling, no one wanted to take this question, so I said, okay, I'll try. This is my own personal beliefs. You know, we don't question those things when you have cancer or diabetes or leukemia. Why should mental illness be any different? It has to do with the chemicals in your brain, and the medication will help stabilize that. How is that any different? Part of what the Mental Health Services Act, the vision and mission of those funds, is to go towards what is called wellness and recovery. Part of wellness and recovery has to do with the whole person. It's about your housing, your job, your family relationships. It's also about your dreams and your goals and your spirituality. And your spirituality should be a part of the healing process. So I think you embrace it, and you embrace your relationship with God, would be my personal, just my own personal belief. And that's part of your recovery. I don't know if there's any family members who wrestled with this issue as well who would want to be brave and speak. Not seeing any.
Oh, no,
yeah, we're going to let Ray Bell talk for a second.
Yeah, let Ray Bell talk. But part of the illness, I agree with you that what's different from, I love to talk, never get the mic, it isn't different from cancer, and it isn't different from leukemia. And part of mental illnesses is agnosia, which is we are not ill. And so that needs to be addressed, too. And I think that's where that question comes from. If a person thinks he or she is not ill, then he or she doesn't need anything or any help. And that's what I've experienced with my loved one. I'm not sick. So I will just continue on and then kill you. Well, take care of the problem.
I'm glad you didn't. Do you want to follow something?
My son didn't want to take medication because of that very thing. He didn't feel that he could take it because of his belief that it would separate him from God. And he's on it now and says he can't believe how much difference it's made and that his life is for the first time normal. And he said, I can't believe the way I was thinking. And he doesn't mean just about that. He means about everything. About all of the... He said that this is a disease about fear. So all I can say is, for the first time, he's seeing God in a whole new light.
Thank you very much. Okay. Did you want to say anything? No? Okay. I was going to ask Dr. Ratanovsky to answer a question about is the higher suicide rate in San Luis Obispo County linked to our older demographic? I think some of you also know that San Luis Obispo County is one of the older counties in the state of California, and so that's the question for you.
Well, you have to excuse me. I'm from New York, so originally. But yes, as far as I could respond to that question, because the highest rate, unfortunately, of people that attempt and complete suicide are the elderly. And that's very sad. And there's quite a few reasons for that. You know, one is people are living longer. People also have other types of disabilities and illness and pain. They get isolated. People tend to go away. They have a lot of grief and loss, a lot of losses in their lives. So, you know, we really need to take care also of our elderly, our older folks, by, you know, trying to help them stay connected and have resources and support and fun and quality of life. Because, you know, sometimes they get very isolated. That's why it's really important that we try to have our primary care physicians be educated and be involved, because that's typically who they would see. Or if anyone has Meals and Wheels programs and programs of that nature. So any agency or community or church that, you know, has elderly is to really, it's important to be educated about that and be concerned. So that is why I didn't know that that's, you have a higher rate of elderly, but that totally makes sense.
Thank you very much. I have a question here I'm going to give to Janice and Jose and Mary, and that is, how will behavioral health and TEMA use the Shaken Tree to educate the community about mental illness? It's a great question.
It is a great question. We're just not sure yet. We have several ideas. We're actually going to meet very soon and make some final decisions exactly where it will go. But I do know that it is going to continue to air throughout the community. Glendon Association has been marvelous in supporting us through this. We have talked about having this air in the Santa Barbara area. We've talked about NAMI airing it possibly in May. NAMI San Luis, I'm hoping NAMI Santa Maria will want to air it. We're not exactly sure where we're going to go with it, but we will be letting people know. And that's a great question, because outside is a sign-up sheet for anyone that is interested in knowing exactly what's going to happen. if these are going to be available, how they're going to be available, when the next viewing will be. So please put your name, address, phone number, email address, and so on. So because we are collecting that now, we have a lot of people who wanted to attend tonight that are saying already, where is the next viewing? So that is a great question. And I wanted Mary and Jose to answer this too, because my understanding is this is also going to end up on public access.
Yeah, we might do that after we just fine-tune a couple little things on it. We might do that. And we are going to submit it to the San Luis Obispo International Film Festival and the Santa Barbara International Film Festival. So we're going to submit it. I don't know what that – see what happens. Thank you.
Can I just take the opportunity with a couple of questions that were asked here about how mental illness is viewed in the family over the last years. I think that I've noticed myself, just in the 8 years of the Family Advocacy Program, how far and open people have come. Are we there? No. We're still a long ways to go. But one of the things I hear about so often are families that have talked about how, you know, this is multi-generational. And they'll go back in their families and look and say, oh, my aunt, my uncle, my grandfather, my father, my brother. It isn't always made available to families. There was a lot, so much stigma and so much shame, and we were led to believe that it was something that the parents did or something that the family did. In our own situation, unfortunately, 20 years after the fact, we had a long list of families, members that had suicided, that had been diagnosed bipolar, manic depression in the time. That would have been great information. I don't blame them because I also know, excuse me, how bad stigma was then. If you can imagine how bad it is now, imagine what it was like 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago. But I have watched families get very strong. And I loved what, I believe it was Marie said in there, because I've always said the same thing. Do I go out and yell in our neighborhood, hey, we've got mental illness in this house? Of course not. But am I ashamed? Absolutely not.
Thanks, Janice. This last question is about laws that we can change, or probably question about advocacy of laws that are coming up. And I know that I don't know of any that are directly on the horizon, but I certainly would encourage you to leave us your information or take information with the Transitions website and email, because I think we do try to get the word out. In addition, Joyce Huddleston, who chairs the Mental Health Board, they also do an update. And so she would probably be very likely to put some advocacy in legislation on that email. And so there certainly are ways that you could get that information. Okay, Ray. There's a sign-up sheet out. Okay. And the NAMI website, the National Alliance of the Mentally Ill website. So there is a lot of information out there. I think if there isn't anything. Oh, whoops, one more question, sorry. This is a hard one. Why is mental illness so stigmatized? Who would like to answer that?
Yeah, well, there's actually one statistic that really proves this point of that it's so stigmatized that I didn't get a chance to go through. But worldwide, there's more disability from mental illness than any other disability. That speaks to stigma worldwide. And, you know, unfortunately, it's a lack of awareness or taking responsibility, caring. There's lots of different reasons. But that says a lot, you know. It speaks loud. And it really is, unfortunately, about a culture. And it's a negative one. And that's what we have a lot of work to do on our part. But also, you know, it was alluded to in the movie. It talks about it. You know, you don't get tuna casseroles. People aren't coming. People move away. Unfortunately, that also happens with some other illnesses as well. I work with people with dementia, and people have and people do that too. And part of that is people don't know what to do or how to do it. So again, raising awareness is crucial to really combating stigma, stereotypes, and a lot of stereotypes. Why do the population homeless? Well, that's the most vulnerable population. They can't advocate for themselves. That's cut. And they gave discounts. You know, you read about that. They give discounts for people that are buying yachts instead. They get a tax break, a loophole. Isn't that nice? So, you know, So some people are aware they're cutting one and giving another. So these are things that we need to be aware of and be educated about, be aware of what's going on politically, and have a voice. Because one thing I learned early on in my career when I went to visit some senators and went to Washington is when we brought up an issue, they said, I didn't get any letters. It's not important. They count the letters, okay? Really important. Writing those letters will change this because they care about your vote. So that's the beginning. Someone else?
Thank you. Thank you very much. Yes? Okay. Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. Let me come around. I think this will be our last one. But if you have a burning question or comment, speak now.
Thank you. Okay, this is just a comment, but I think one of the problems is family members may be ready to get past the stigma, but some of the people who are suffering are still having an enormously hard time. And you're in a bind when you try to talk about your own story, but you want to protect their privacy. And I think one of the reasons is that everybody has such a strong feeling that you could overcome this by an effort of will. If you're not trying hard enough, you're not believing in God enough, or whatever it is, it's really hard to believe. It's frightening that this could happen to any of us or to a family member. It's terrifying. We want to think that if we do the best we can as parents or as family members, that this isn't going to happen, but it's not true. It's a complex biochemical illness, and some degree of effort can make symptoms, there's some degree to which symptoms can be controlled, but that's only to a degree.
I have to endorse what you said, Doctor. Prejudice and fear are born of ignorance. And in this county, the family-to-family program has served just over 400 families. The fewest we've ever had are from this community, this educational community here in San Luis Obispo. And as the coordinator of the class in the county, I've tried to figure out why, population-wise, this is the biggest town. So statistically, we should be drawing at least a proportionate share from San Luis Obispo. I think part of the stigma comes from the intellectual approach that, one, not knowing what mental illness is, we can see a broken arm. We can get things to show up on an X-ray if you have a tumor. But the mind, the brain, if we just went through the decade of the brain in the last decade, is a new frontier. And historically, mental illness, or I like to call it brain disease, talk about applying appropriate terminology. I try not to use mental illness anymore because it's a brain disease. As you, Karen, identified, it isn't a chemical imbalance in the brain that facilitates these things. It's brain disease, just like heart disease or pancreatic disease. So I think the advocacy, here we have a powerful group here to advocate for education. That's what's going to break down the stigma, and that's what has broken down stigma to the degree that it has. Education, family to family is an excellent education program, leads to empowerment, and empowerment fuels hope.
Thank you, John. Truer words have not been spoken. Well, I think I'm going to wrap it up because I'm trying to be on time, which is very rare for me, for those of you who know me. We have a reception afterwards, so we have some refreshments. We hope you all stay. There's a lot of information about suicide prevention, and information about NAMI, information about family to family, a lot of information and resources, and we encourage you to take some things for yourself or for friends or loved ones, anything that you are interested in, and please take information that might link you back up to one of us if you have any further questions or want to talk to any of us further. We are here as resources. I mean, the County Department of Behavioral Health, NAMI, Transitions, there are a lot of resources out here, and sometimes it's just a matter of finding them, as I think you heard in the documentary. We're also going to replay the film. I think we're going to replay it now. after you all leave who don't want to see it again. And I just want to thank you very much again. We're really delighted that this is a full room, and we had to turn people away. So that's a great sign. That's a sign of change, too. So thank you all for coming, and let's make this the first of many opportunities and conversation.
One in four persons suffer from mental illness. Starts to display symptoms of mental illness. You may not even know what it is. You just know that something's wrong.
With my first wife, Pauline, I didn't realize she had a mental illness. You know, I knew her mother, you know, had problems because, like, one time her mother had a fence built on the roof, a barbed wire fence built on the roof, and that kind of, you know, tipped me off.
When we go to diagnose mental illness, what we're looking at is, like, supposedly discrete categories. Somebody has major depression, or they have bipolar disorder, or they have schizophrenia. But rarely do people fit a simple symptom picture like that. And you've got a lot of people who have a lot of different problems, so it's not such a clear-cut issue.
When we discovered our daughter was diagnosed with bipolar disorder, for one, I had no idea. I don't know where I was in the universe, but I never heard bipolar.
He had voices going on, and I found out recently he actually was seeing people just standing that weren't there.
We had no indication that our son was ever thinking about suicide or that that was even an option. He'd never given us any indication, never said anything, never made threats. He was not a troubled kid. We saw that he dealt with depression. We could see the severe highs and severe lows, but it didn't seem anything out of the ordinary, very much like any teenager.
She was a cutter. She cut herself.
When someone first finds out that their
loved one is diagnosed with mental illness, there, it's an incredible deep down pain inside.
When it first started to become apparent how serious it was, I searched my mind like how I would describe it, and the term tragic nightmare